for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, podcasting now on Apple's iTunes. Welcome to our program. It's the last day of the week. Time for our Brunch with Bernie segment. Just, by the way, as a heads up, in the second hour of the program, we're going to be talking with somebody from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Angela Logamonsi, who is going to tell us that all those cancer-causing chemicals that they're finding in cord blood in babies and in our bodies really are nothing to worry about. So we will hear from the toxics industry. It should be a fascinating discussion. But first, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the only independent member of the House of Representatives, the longest serving member of the House of Representatives in its history, independent member of the House of Representatives. His website, bernie.house.gov or bernie.org. And now we have, if you go to tomhartman.com, where you can also drop into our live chat room, you will see an ad for Bernie, and you can click on his picture there, and it'll take you right over to bernie.org, his website. And so, Congressman Bernie Sanders, welcome to our program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you here, Bernie. By the way, if you want to talk with Bernie, if you have questions, thoughts, comments, whatever, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. Bernie, CAFTA just passed.
Well, it was a busy week in Washington. Actually, we just cast our final vote on the transportation bill, and Congress will be adjourned for about 5 weeks now. But it was a busy week. We had the transportation bill. We had CAFTA. We had the energy bill. So let me go over some of those things. CAFTA, as I think everybody knows, ended up passing late in the night by two votes. I voted against CAFTA. I think CAFTA is a continuation of an absolutely disastrous trade policy, which has cost us millions of decent-paying jobs. It is lowering wages for American workers, exacerbating the gap between the rich and the poor. And the arguments that I heard in favor of it were just, to my mind, totally off the wall. In fact, their arguments from an economic point of view, they used to tell us that NAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China were just going to create all kinds of new jobs for America, and that's why we needed unfettered free trade. Remember that, Tom?
I remember it well, starting with Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr.
Well, they don't even bother to go into those arguments anymore because everybody knows that those arguments just aren't worth the paper that they're written on. They have failed. We're losing millions of good-paying jobs. We have a record-breaking trade deficit of $618 billion, which is only going to go up. The middle class is shrinking. Poverty is increasing. Bush has created virtually no new net private sector jobs. So I don't have a whole lot to say. Guess what the argument is now for CAFTA? It's part of the fight against terrorism.
Of course. Everything is that involves
money
for Republicans.
So forget the economics. They can't defend that anymore. And if we don't pass CAFTA, you're going to have Fidel Castro. Daniel Ortega, remember that name from past?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Daniel Ortega is once again one of the great threats to the American way of life. Chavez in Venezuela is another great threat. So we have to pass CAFTA in order to stop, I guess it's communism again or something like that.
So we're going to let the multinational corporations do our work for us down in Central America by having everybody work in the sweatshop so we don't have to worry about them saying that they want land or jobs.
But an incredible rewrite of American, Latin American history took place on the floor of the House. But be that as it may, the guys don't even try to defend anymore the nonsense that these unfettered free trade agreements work well for American workers. Don't even bother talking about that. So we kind of knew as we walked in there that because of the enormous pressure that corporate America was putting on members of Congress, including most specifically Republicans who were wavering on it, there are a growing number of Republicans who are saying, you know, this deal really isn't what they told us. It's not working. We're losing jobs back home. The new jobs that are being created, low-wage, poor benefits. They know that. But what happened is groups like the National Chamber of Commerce and other business groups were saying, literally, if you don't vote for CAFTA, don't expect to get any campaign contributions. Then you had the president twisting arms, coming to Capitol Hill, which is quite unusual. Vice president was here a few hours before the vote. Republican leadership was dangling roads and bridges that were going to be in the transportation Bill, to these guys, tremendous pressure. Funny thing happened. At the end of regulation time,
which is 15 minutes, right?
17 minutes.
17.
The vote had won. They had the votes. They were ahead, I believe, somewhere like 214 to 211. But seven or eight Republicans had not cast their votes. And the dynamic there was these guys had told folks back home they were going to vote against CAFTA or they had serious reservations about CAFTA, and they're sitting there not having cast their votes. So they worked out something, and some of them ended up having to vote, walking the plank, voting for it. Others ended up voting against it. It ended up winning by two votes. But what you saw there is really what power politics is about, the pressure of the president, the vice president, corporate America, the Republican leadership. But the good news, if there is good news, is to understand that CAFTA itself, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, from an economic point of view, is really small potatoes. Compared to China, compared to NAFTA, it is really nickel and dime stuff. What this whole debate and vote was about was a referendum in many ways on whether or not we want to continue this disastrous trade policy. And I think those of us who have strong reservations about PNTR with China and NAFTA and CAFTA, I think should take some solace from the fact that more and more people in Congress, in fact the majority without that pressure, are now saying, wait a second, this trade approach is not working. We've got to rethink it fundamentally. We've got to get corporate America to start reinvesting in the United States of America and not in China. So the momentum, despite the fact that they squeaked out under tremendous pressure, a victory, no question that on the trade issue, the momentum is with us. The people of America want to change our trade policies, as do the people in Congress.
Bernie, you mentioned PNTR, Permanent Normal Trade Relations. I think a lot of Americans don't know what that means. In fact, I heard on one of the TV talk shows last night, a con was on there, and he was saying, well, you know, we don't have trade deals with China. We don't have trade deals with Europe like we're going to have with, you know, the Central American countries with CAFTA. And that's why we have such a big deficit with them, quack, quack, quack. I mean, it was just obvious nonsense. But I think most Americans don't understand what permanent normal trade relations means. Can you explain that?
Well, years ago, what happened is, as Reagan and friends moved toward unfettered free trade, what they started was in dealing with the communist countries, most favored nation status, which meant that you would move toward lower tariffs with certain communist countries. What happened is every single year there would be a vote on the floor of the House whether or not to continue MFN, most favored nation status, with China and with other countries. And that gave members of Congress a chance to evaluate how that policy was working. What permanent normal trade relations did was move away with the MFN status, make it permanent, if you like, and move towards substantially lowering tariffs and trade barriers between China and the United States on a permanent basis. Now, what the impetus behind that and the real force behind that was the large multinational corporations who, while they told us, their argument was, think about the huge potential market that exists in China. Think about all of the products we're going to sell from the United States to China, all of the jobs that we're going to create in the United States. That was their line. The reality, of course, is, hey, what an opportunity to throw American workers out on the street, not have to pay people $20 an hour, run to China, hire people at 50 cents an hour. They can't form unions. They have no political rights. The environmental protection is a disaster. We want to go to China. That was really the impetus, and that, in fact, is what is happening. That's why we have a $160 billion trade deficit with China today, and that number is growing. And I know a lot of the listeners are hearing, legislation, we're in Congress, the president, everyone's, we're concerned about this, that aspect of our China relationship. All of that is mostly very, very superficial stuff. The bottom line is, to my mind at least, that when you have a unfettered free trade agreement with China, where on the other side people are paid 30 cents an hour or 50 cents an hour, have no political freedom, it is inherently unfair to American workers, and there's nothing you can put on it, no language, no studies that are going to make it fair. American workers cannot and should not be asked to compete against desperate people who make pennies an hour. Corporate America understands that. They are moving to China in droves. And it's not just blue-collar jobs, as I've mentioned many times before. It's going to increasingly be white-collar jobs as well. So we got to rethink our trade policies with China. Trade is a good thing when it works for both sides. These trade agreements are only working for the CEOs right now of large corporations, who, by the way, listeners will be happy to know that while the middle class struggles, while poverty increases, while real wages remain at best stagnant, Do you know what the increase in compensation for the CEOs of the Forbes 500 last year was, Tom?
I shudder to think.
54%. How's that? So if many of the listeners...
We should do so well.
Many of the working people are making 54%. I congratulate you. Ain't too many of them.
54% more than they made last year.
Yeah, 54% increase. So the gap between the rich and the poor grows wide, and that's the impetus behind these terrible trade agreements.
Now, there's these so-called centrists, the Democratic Leadership Council or Committee or whatever it is, these groups within the Democratic Party and some within the Republican Party who, sensing this turmoil, this concern among Americans about the situation, are coming forward and saying, oh, well, we can just tweak these trade agreements
right.
by, for example, giving labor protection. So we're going to let the folks in China or, it'll never happen in
That's
China.
Not, in my view, Tom, that it's not worth the paper it's written on.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. That's what I meant before. They're trying to put a lot of language onto these things, environmental stuff. It's by and large meaningless.
Yeah, it's putting lipstick on a pig. I mean, if you
exactly.
have a trade union in Nicaragua, and instead of working for 50 cents an hour, they're now working for 70 cents an hour, which is probably...
But it's not even that. Yeah. It's helping them, having them enforce their own labor laws. You have 40% of the people in Central America are working, I believe, for less than $2 a day. So, you know, you have workers with no rights at all in many of these countries.
Yeah.
The issue here is not only... And importantly, we've got to protect the American middle class, because if we don't, our kids, for the first time in the modern history of this country, will have actually a lower standard of living than we do, despite, and this is an important point, huge increases in worker productivity, okay? But we also have got to be cognizant that poverty does exist in Central America, in Latin America, in China, and around the world. And I have, as I've said many, many, and many times, not only the United States, but the rest of the industrialized world, I've got to do everything that we can to uplift the poorest people in this world from poverty. There are kids who are dying today, children all over the world from preventable diseases, children who are not being educated, healthcare disasters, educational disasters, food disasters. We have got to work on that. But I absolutely believe you don't have to destroy the middle class. And suddenly all of these right-wing people are now suddenly, oh, they're staying up nights worrying about the poor people in China and in Latin America. Well, if you believe that, there's a good bridge in Brooklyn you might want to be buying.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, of course, that's not their motive.
Yeah.
That's just,
yeah.
you know. So that, now the other bill that was passed yesterday was an energy bill, which again, which had, by the way, too much. Well, let me go back to CAFTA, by the way. It was, you saw some Republicans, 20-some-odd, voting against it. But unfortunately, over 15 Democrats voted for this very bad bill.
Right. And 15 Democrats who I think a lot of folks are thinking should be targeted.
That's what people are saying.
Yeah. Very, very. And 9 of them also voted for the bankruptcy bill as well. And this is just absolutely wrong. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, America's congressman, in my mind, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. We'll be back with your phone calls for Bernie right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
One of Congress's great truth tellers, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives with us, America's congressman, in my opinion, Congressman Bernie Sanders, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And also, if you want to visit Bernie's website, you'll find his picture on my homepage there at tomhartman.com. You can just click on it, it'll get you over to him. Or you can go to house.bernie.gov or bernie.org. 1-866-889-8894. Derek in Woodbridge, Virginia on the line. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
It's an honor to finally be able to speak with you, Congressman.
Good to talk to you.
I have a quick question and a comment. About 3 hours ago, about 9 o'clock Eastern, I gave my Congressman, Tom Davis of Virginia, a call and asked him why he voted for CAFTA. And I got a staffer, and we had a discussion and for about an hour on the subject.
Huh.
And went through every single topic, kept on going with his talking points, and I would just interrupt him and correct him, and it was a pretty interesting discussion.
Good.
And basically the guy had to apologize for not having his talking points better. So my question is, now that this is over and everything, what do we do now?
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, while we lost the vote, CAFTA unto itself is a very small economic trade agreement, very small. Central American countries combined are really not much. What we have got to do now is shift the focus and not only work to prevent any new trade agreements, but really revisit NAFTA, revisit permanent normal trade relations with China and agreements. I have introduced legislation which has over 70 co-sponsors which would repeal permanent normal trade relations with China. So I think the goal now is, as we have the momentum, and I believe that we do, despite the CAFTA loss, is to start putting pressure, and you did exactly the right thing, writing members of Congress, making sure that it becomes a major campaign issue. As I indicated a moment ago, there are a number of Republicans who voted for that bill against their instincts. They did not want to do that. They know the folks back home didn't want to do it. So what we have to do is say trade is good, and we've got to develop trade policies which protect the middle class of this country and not just the CEOs of large corporations. You did exactly the right thing by engaging Congressman Davis's office. Write to him, work with people to email him, hold town meetings on the issue. The momentum is with us. Let's keep up the pressure.
Well said. Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma on the line. Glenn, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. I was hearing about the congressman who said his vote no was recorded as abstain. Is he just lying? Can he change his vote back?
I only heard. I didn't see anything.
I spoke with his office yesterday, Bernie.
And what was the story? That he said he voted and it didn't record it?
That's right. He said he voted no and that it didn't record as abstained. It simply didn't record at all. And he issued a release, and in fact they sent me an email of it yesterday afternoon, which said that in fact he voted no. He wants the people in his district to know that he voted no. But it didn't get recorded, but it wouldn't have changed the outcome anyway because it was a two-vote margin.
All that I can say, I was not watching him, where he put his finger. All I can say is these machines usually work pretty well.
Yeah, okay. So maybe he chickened out at the last minute.
Well, what happens, what I was telling you is that for an hour, they had the votes. For an hour, I can't remember, it was 7 or 8 Republicans, all of had either indicated they were going to vote against CAFTA or had expressed serious concerns about it, they weren't casting their vote.
Yeah.
They were sitting there.
They were afraid to take on Tom DeLay? Do you think that's what it
was? Well, that's right. I mean, but they had to. Their dilemma was, if you don't vote, you look like a fool. They didn't want to vote for it. And if they all voted against it, the thing would have lost. That was the dilemma that the Republicans had. So they worked out a deal with some of them voted for it, and others ended up voting against it. Apparently, this gentleman didn't do anything. So.
Yeah, or he tried to vote no, and right, maybe his finger just hit the wall, and he thought it was.
Could have been. We don't
Who knows? Yeah, these voting machines—you just can't trust them, right? Who knows? Okay, we're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our number 866-889-8894. We'll be back with your calls for Congressman Bernie Sanders right after this. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What was it you wanted? Tell me again so I know. What's happening in there? What's going on in your show?
And welcome back, my friends. It's Tom Hartman. We're here with you 27 minutes before the hour, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our program brought to you today and has been actually for almost 2 years now by Small Dog Electronics, high technology for low prices. If you appreciate the program and if you need anything computer, they specialize in Macintosh, but they also work with PCs. They sell them. They service them. They can give you advice. Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS for all things computer. 1-800-511-MAX, Small Dog Electronics. And a special thank you to them for their support of this program all this time. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. And Seth is calling from Pittsburgh, WPTT. Hey, Seth, you're live with Congressman Sanders. Seth, you got to turn down your radio and listen to the phone. Okay, Seth, I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll come back to you. 1-866-889-8894. Margaret, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Margaret.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm calling from the Asheville area, North Carolina, which is Charles Taylor's, Representative Charles Taylor's, and the absentee vote thing that he threw. I would like to say he consistently votes the Republican Party line, so it's hard to believe him. But I'm not devastated, but I'm just really sad seeing my country. We are not we are not about the people of America. We are about destroying the people of America. Mr. Sanders, the most important thing to me in CAFTA is that I have used alternative health methods, vitamins and herbs and so on, for the last 35 years because I can't afford health insurance. I'm that lower middle class or whatever, mid-middle class that just can't do it. And I'm healthy as a result of what I have taught myself, researched, and learned about all my choices for vitamins and herbs and so on and so forth. And in this CAFTA bill, buried in it, I suppose, is the Kodak thing from the WTO that Europe has voted on and so on and so forth. And it's going to take away my ability to choose my own alternative health choices. What can I do about that?
Well, Margaret is raising a very important issue. That is, well, for a start, Margaret, it's unfortunate that you and 45 million other Americans have no health insurance. That is an outrage. And obviously, we have got to move toward a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people, as every other industrialized country on the earth does. But in addition to that, I think you're raising questions about alternative medicine. And the reality is whether or not people have conventional health insurance or not, millions and millions and millions of people are looking to alternative medicine, whether it's acupuncture, whether it's chiropractic care, whether it's herbal remedy, nutrition, or whatever it is. And my own view is that, by and large, with some exceptions, the American people should be making the choices regarding their own health care. And we are making, by the way, some progress on that. And Margaret, one of the things that we want to do is make sure that insurance companies provide alternative health care as one of the options for people who buy that insurance. The only concern that I do have about it is clearly there are some people in that business who are fraudulent, who tell you take this pill and you're going to cure cancer and so forth and so on. And that's not a good thing.
But maybe there's some confusion here, Bernie. Article 3 of CAFTA says that the United States food laws will be brought into accordance with international norms. And some folks have been suggesting that what that means is that we will have to adopt the Codex Alimentarius, which the High Court in Europe just ruled means that vitamins and herbs become prescription items. Do you think that that's actually the case?
I frankly don't see that happening. I don't see that happening. Okay. And obviously that's something we don't want to happen.
Yeah, I think if that were to happen, the blowback would be incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Let's move along. Nick in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I'm wondering while you're on the air, is it feasible to read off the names of the Democrats that voted for this bill? So, because we don't know, and I don't know exactly how we can find out who actually voted how.
Nick, I'd be glad to do that in the second hour of the program. I don't have the list right in front of me. I did do that yesterday. I read it on the air several times. We'll get back to that when we come back.
15 Democrats who voted yes. And I think 27 Republicans who voted no.
Yeah, and we've also had several people call. Louise lets me know. We've had several people call wanting to know who were the Republicans who voted no, so that people can call their offices and thank them for standing up for America.
That's absolutely a good thing.
Particularly if they're in your area. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Bob in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WTKG. Hey, Bob.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Bernie, I don't hear anybody in Congress speaking up about how the Chinese, especially the lower echelon people in the military, are threatening us with the military force. Why is it nobody outside of yourself seems to raise anything along that line? Why do they not say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? Maybe we better think twice about doing business with these people.
Well, I think Bob, Tom, and I discussed this a couple of weeks ago. There was a front-page story in the Financial Times, if I'm not mistaken, where a senior a senior Chinese military leader was suggesting preemptive attacks against the United States if the United States got involved in the Taiwan issue. And it was a very provocative statement. In addition to that, we do know that China is developing its military and its weapon systems very aggressively. One of the reasons that I introduced and got passed in the House of Representatives an amendment which would kill an export-import bank loan to build four nuclear power plants in China is that the Chinese would get that technology, and that particular company has been involved in spreading nuclear information to Pakistan and Iran, I believe. So a growing number of people are concerned about the Chinese military threat. And when we talk about trade agreements, it's not only the loss of jobs in America. There is a growing concern that what China is doing is taking the new technology. When Boeing builds airplanes in China, it's not just the cheap labor that China is providing, but China, from its position, is demanding the technology so that in the future they're not going to need Boeing, they're not going to need other large companies. They'll be able to do it themselves. Some people say, don't worry, this is not for military purposes. Obviously, many people think that it's a dual use and it can be converted to military. So to answer your question, Bob, there is a growing concern not only about China's growing military force, the fact that they own several $100 billion of our debt, and so forth.
But Bernie, just as an FYI, in today's Washington Times, a report about Chen Yongling, a diplomat who defected to Australia from China, and he said China is building up its nuclear forces as part of a secret strategy targeting the United States. Yeah, they call it proactive defense. And quoting him, he said Beijing's leaders are prepared now to launch a preemptive attack on the country considered a huge threat to China. That would be the United States specifically. And that's in today's Washington Times. So it's getting out there. And kind of scary stuff.
And, you know, as part of that, and again, let me be very clear. I do not, to the degree that we can prevent another Cold War with China, I want to prevent that one. I want to demonize the Chinese and so forth and so on. They're an important part of the world community. We want peace with them. We want a good relationship with them. But it does concern me very much that you have the CEOs of large corporations who are saying it as vocally and as loudly as you can imagine. They're not hiding it. They are basically saying, we are moving to China big time. That's where we're going to set up. You name the industry, they are going there. And I think that is a real disservice to the workers of this country who have built those corporations, the consumers of this country who have purchased those products that these companies have made. And it's high time we had a serious discussion about that.
Yeah, well said. Sean in Washington. Hey, Sean.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. You know, I want to make a couple of points and ask a question here. First, you know, I really have to laugh when I hear the congressman talk about how, you know, him and his colleagues are the champions of the middle class, and they're looking out for us when, you know, I get my paycheck every couple of weeks, and, you know, a substantial chunk of it is gone in taxes. I never see anything of it. Two, on that, you know, you guys want to sit there and bash CEOs for making so much money, but yet over the last 10 years, the House of Representatives have given themselves a $50,000 pay increase. I mean, it's a joke. My question is, rather than bash these trade agreements, why don't we look at, you know, fixing the situation here in this country so that these businesses want to stay through education and, you know, having a better skilled workers so that these companies don't jump ship and leave and go offshore to Central America and China. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay, well, thank you, Sean. Sean is making an argument that many people do make, is that the reason that companies are going abroad is because our educational system is failing and so forth and so on. And obviously, we do have to do a lot more to improve education in the United States, which is a serious problem. But at the end of the day, because I've heard this argument for 20 years, at the end of the day, you could have the best educated workforce in the world, the most willing workers in the world. They cannot compete against people who make 50 cents an hour. And what corporate America is doing is leading us into a race to the bottom. The problem is not that our workers are not competitive. We can do better. The problem is not primarily that our people are not uneducated. We can do better. The problem is that wages and benefits and environmental protections in the United States are higher than they are in China, are higher than they are in Central America. And you could have all the education in the world, and if a company has to make a choice as to whether they're going to pay somebody 30 cents an hour or $15 an hour, a living wage in America, they're going to go to China. So I think ignoring what is the implications of these trade agreements, the race to the bottom, the fact that corporate America is leaving this country for cheap labor is to miss the most important point.
Yeah, I think Sean and most people who make those arguments don't understand how for over 200 years America protected our domestic industries with tariffs. And but anyhow, this is your rant, not mine.
And when he says bashing the CEO, it's not a question of bashing. The question is to take a hard look at what is going on. And I think a hard, objective analysis will tell you that many of these companies are literally selling out the American people and are going to China and are going to other low-wage countries despite all of the benefits that they have received. And one of the things that really disturbs me is that when you have programs like the Export-Import Bank, when you have the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which provides insurance to corporations to go abroad, American taxpayers are directly subsidizing these large corporations who are moving abroad, and that is corporate welfare at its worst.
1-866-889-8894. Greg in Portland, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, how you doing, guys?
Good.
Bernie, I love you, Ben, because you talk the talk, it's the walk the walk. These other guys, these 15 Democrats and the 9 before that voted for the bankruptcy bill, to me, they're traitors to their party. I don't like to pussyfoot around. You know, you call them, well, you know, they might be confused. They're looking for some kind of deal. The traitors to the party, the traitors to the American working people. And they have to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And this China thing, China's not going to nuke us because we're feeding them. We're their breadbasket now. All their technology, they won't nuke us until they have all our companies. Then they'll feel free to nuke us. So then they won't be cutting the umbilical cord. Right? So we got a few years to go there. There's a whole bunch. I'm like an aggressive progressive. I hate these guys with a passion.
Is there a question in there, Greg?
I don't know. I'm just kind of ranting.
Well, Greg is ranting, but you know, I like Greg's rant more than I like Sean's rant.
Well, Sean's an idiot. You know, CEO bashing and blame it on the workers.
That's exactly what we write. So, the problem with America is workers are making too much money. The problem with America is we protect our environment. Clock. And I think we got to stand up and say it and point the finger. And we have the power to do this. Because the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, the United States of America remains the most lucrative market in the world. Everybody wants to sell their products here. And what we have got to do is say, no problem. We want you to sell your products here. But you can't sell your products here unless you're investing in this country. You're not going to be spending billions of dollars just investing in China. We have leverage. We have power, which we have not exercised. And the real bottom line of this whole issue, on issue after issue after issue, it is money that talks. Money talks. And these corporations are piling huge sums of money into the political process, and unfortunately, members of Congress are listening to them. And what we need to do is have a political revolution in this country where ordinary people are standing up, they're educated on this issue, they put pressure on their elected officials to represent their needs. You don't have to give billions and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the richest 1% and then cut back on what our veterans are getting, cut back on education, cut back on environmental protection. That is totally asinine and simply reflects the interest of the wealthy and the powerful.
Bonnie in Pennsylvania, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Well, thank you both for serving our country, one in the private and one in the public sector. I have two questions. First has to do with this announcement about the war that we're going to bring home our service people in the spring. Do you think that's calculated so that way the 2006 election will be better for the Republicans? And my second question would be, I tried to call my Congressman Tim Murphy, who's kind of like a wind-up doll. He just does everything that the Bush and Cheney and delay team want him to do. But I try to call him in the evening, and the switchboard is down. Now, can people go in, or is it just lobbyists who have access that late in the evening?
No, I mean, different offices have, you know, handle things differently, but generally speaking, you should be able to walk into your congressman's office. I think probably the local offices, the home offices, are kept open 9 to 5. We close at 5:30. And in Washington, sometimes people are opening as well because votes don't take place until quite late.
Yeah. Thank
you, Bonnie. So the door should be open.
Thank you, Bonnie, for that call. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, house.bernie.gov, his website, or bernie.org. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, or tomhartman.com on the web. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the radio home of democracy, the Tom Hartman radio program where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, the first hour of our Friday program, always Brunch with Bernie, Congressman Bernie Sanders. And our phone lines are totally full here, Bernie. We're going to try and go through this as quickly as we can. Herman in Palm Springs, California. Hey, Herman, what's up?
Morning, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Two things. One, you know, as far as having a Cold War with China, it seemed to work against the USSR. And if we made it not profitable for U.S. companies to go through these loopholes, taking their business over, you know, overseas to bring the products back here, and made it less expensive, in other words, maybe tariffs or some kind of incentive to stay in America instead of letting them go overseas just to increase their bottom line, would probably be a way to get rid of that trade imbalance.
Well, Herm, that's exactly right, and that's exactly what we're working on right now. What's going on today is companies throwing American workers out on the street, hiring people for pennies an hour, and then they bring the product back to this country.
Yeah, it's
tariff-free.
Insane. Who are you going to sell it to when all the Americans are on welfare?
Okay. I'm sorry, Herman. I got to move along. Matt in Kansas. Hey, Matt.
Just a quick observation. I'll hang up and listen to your comments. You know, we don't particularly care for the DLC, and I understand that, especially me as a 22-year union member. What frustrates me is if we don't like the DLC and we don't like people like Joe Biden get their money from corporate interests, we, the people, need to start financing campaigns. We complain and complain and complain, and we don't get out there and we don't help finance the campaigns. It's too bad it's all about money. But we have to step up and help Howard Dean and the DNC finance these campaigns.
Matt makes a good and I think there has been a revolution in recent years with MoveOn.org and other organizations where people are contributing $25, $50 so that candidates and parties do not have to just be dependent on big money interest. What I have to say is we also have to move, in my view, to public financing of elections so it does not become, as the Matt just indicated, all about money, and candidates do not have to spend half their lives hustling money.
Okay, just a few seconds left here. Armin in Florida.
Hey, guys, I go to the mall for coffee in the afternoons in Bradenton, Florida, and there's a welfare class that hangs around there. No job, no future. Somebody's paying for their housing, their health care, and their food. And my question is, what are you going to teach people like that when China's training MBAs for 10 cents on the dollar?
Good point.
Bernie?
Well, look, the point is we have to educate people. We have to have jobs for American workers to pay them a decent wage.
Yeah, that's got to be the bottom line. We have to bring back our industrial infrastructure. Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us today, Bernie.
Okay, we'll see you next week.
Always a pleasure. Yep, we'll see you next week. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the real free speech zone. No passes from the RNC required, no barbed wire. We won't drag you off if you have a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. Well, thanks for being with us on the program. We'll be back right after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Outside the United States, 503-248-0620. TomHartman.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Are chemicals in the human body a problem or not? This recent study that was done on umbilical cord blood pulled by the Red Cross and studied by the Environmental Working Group, suggesting maybe we should be concerned. On the other hand, the Competitive Enterprise Institute suggesting nothing to worry about. Angela Logomassini is with us. Angela is the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Director of Risk and Environmental Policy. Hey, Angela, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Pleased to have you here. Tell us why we shouldn't be concerned about these chemicals that we're finding in our bloodstream and in our babies' bloodstreams.
Well, you have to remember, chemicals have always been present in the human body. The question is, as they change over time, what is the public health impact? And about a week ago, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put out a study. Basically, they did a systematic review of chemicals in the human body, and they conclude, or one of the things that they note under their list of interpretations, the first sentence they say is, the fact that there are chemicals in the human body is not something that necessarily means there's a disease problem. That trace levels, and all the ones that they looked at were at safe levels. Trace levels are, that's part of being human, and we're not seeing adverse impacts from them. In fact, if you look throughout history, even though we have more man-made chemicals than ever before, people are living longer, healthier lives, and there's less cancer and things that a lot of groups are trying to make some fear about. There have been groups by Environmental Working Group, as you noted earlier, and others that are trying to use this basically to hype the issue without...
Well, Angela, I'm looking at a study here that's published on the BBC. You can find it at news.bbc.co.uk. The headline is, Worldwide Cancer Cases Double. And they point out that in Africa, 4% of deaths are from cancer, whereas it's 19% in Europe. And that's after they filter out the AIDS variable in there. They suggest that perhaps the chemicals of the developed world could account for the fact that now 1 in 3 Americans will get cancer in their lifetime, whereas at the turn of the century, it was about 1 in 20.
Well, you have to remember something. At the time, at the turn of the century, people were dying from tuberculosis. They were dying from a whole host of other problems that before they even could get cancer. And since cancer is a disease of aging, as people live longer and longer, you'll have a higher percentage of people getting cancer.
But if you filter out infant mortality from the pre-antibiotic era, filter out the infant mortality, I mean, Thomas Jefferson lived into his 70s. John Adams lived into his 80s. We're looking at about a 7-year average increase in lifespan from 1900 to the year 2000 once you take out infant mortality.
Lots of women died in childbirth. There were a lot of other things that took people out a lot younger. However, the data that I've looked at and the studies that I've looked at, the National Cancer Institute, all show that cancer rates are actually going down. When you take out things like smoking, you account for...
That's why they're going down, is because fewer people are smoking.
I don't have that particular BBC study on hand, but you also have to look at, sort of per 100,000 people in the population, because the population numbers get bigger, it will look like the proportion of cancer is higher. If you look at the latest data from the National Cancer Institute, and they do a collaborative effort with a lot of the top cancer researchers around the world, rates are down.
Well, here what the BBC says is the proportion of the global population with cancer currently stands at 10%, but is predicted to increase to 22% by 2050, cancer research says.
Right.
Cancer Research UK.
People are living longer and longer, and you have to, look at the bigger, you have to look at all the factors. Now, the question is, a lot of people are saying these are chemically caused, and I don't think that there's a lot of data to support that. But again, getting back to the basic data, I mean, I don't know what news organization may say one thing, but what I've looked at is what the best cancer researchers in the world are saying, and they analyzed this throughout the last decade and through the last century, and in the last decade in particular, things have been going down, including even even breast cancer.
Now, we know that cancer, for example, in children has doubled in the last 25 years.
Again, the National Cancer Institute did a report on that and said it appears, but actually better detection is a big factor in that. And you're also looking at a very small number of cancers for children and brain cancer. So if you have, you know, a handful a year and you have one more, it looks like a bigger increase.
Okay, we're talking with Angela Logomassini of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Angela, your organization is funded by CSX Corporation, Ford Motor Company Fund, Philip Morris Companies, Texaco, Dow Chemical. Why should we believe you?
We are a nonprofit charitable organization. We accept donations from anybody who supports our cause. We're a very small, limited government group. We're a philosophical group. We believe in free enterprise. Lots of the environmental groups get all sorts of funding from different groups as well. We get, just like they do, money from individuals and foundations. You have to look at the quality of the research, too. If you want to back reference any of my sources, I certainly welcome you to. The National Cancer Institute puts out an annual report on the state of cancer.
And your website is cei.org?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And of course, PRWatch.org is the group that has documented, your budget, $2.9 million for the last year that you reported a 990. And CEI, you guys are really out there, by the way. I have to say I'm impressed by that. I'm constantly seeing folks from Competitive Enterprise Institute on doing TV shows, representing themselves as experts and suggesting that there's really no problem here. But what about this study where they pulled this blood from the umbilical cords of babies? The blood sample with the lowest reading contained 154 chemicals. The highest held 231. And they point out that over 100 of these chemicals are known carcinogens.
Well, you know, again, going back to this study that the CDC put out, which is the best on this research, they do note, you know, low-level chemicals in the human body are not a sign of disease or a problem. They've always been there. Cavemen have chemicals in their body. They were just different than the ones
we're made of chemicals. But
we're talking
the chemicals that we're talking about here, these 154
right.
231
well,
are industrial chemicals.
Yes. So they're man-made. Again, getting back to what is happening with public health. Are we getting sicker? Are we getting healthier? Are people living longer? Yes, they're living longer, healthier lives. Fewer people are getting cancer. Fewer people are dying from cancer. This is all well documented on the National Institutes for Health Research. And if you look at the CDC report, they actually report that levels are going down, lead levels are going down, environmental tobacco smoke, residual chemicals are going down, lots of pesticides.
But Angela, if you look at that CDC study, they point out in there that the biggest single variable is the decrease in smoking in the United States with regard to cancer. Spectrum of cancers that are actually increasing in the United States.
Okay, well, we went through some of those, and I think we had some disagreements. For instance, brain cancer.
Children.
According to the National Cancer Institute, it is basically stable, and it has been stable. There's better reporting, which makes it appear that it has gone up.
Cancer in children has doubled in the last 25 years.
I will have to look at that one. But again, you have to look at detection and other factors.
Let's just look at the cellular level. If an individual cell, if the DNA in an individual cell is assaulted by a cancer-causing chemical in such a way that the DNA is damaged and the cell starts reproducing like crazy, you've got cancer, right? Cancer always starts with one cell. It's not a matter of, you know, the level of a cancer-causing compound in the bloodstream is going to, you know, if you have high quantities of it, it's going to hit many more cells, and odds are, you know, much higher that one of those cells is going to become cancerous. But really, it only takes one molecule of a cancer-causing chemical hitting one cell the right way in order to produce cancer. How can you suggest that, well, the levels are low, so we really don't have to worry?
Because that's what all good science and good scientific researchers would tell you, that the risk is negligible. And in fact, you know, it's long-term. For instance, people who smoke one cigarette in life, their risk of cancer from that is very small, if close to non-existent. If you smoke two packs a day for your entire life, your cancer risk is elevated.
Right, but why even smoke one cigarette?
What?
Why even smoke one cigarette if it's going to if there's going to be a small increase in the probability of cancer?
So are you suggesting, can I ask you something? Are you suggesting to get rid of all chemicals in society?
I'm suggesting that we should adopt in the United States the precautionary principle that's used in Europe, and that is that of the 80,000 chemicals that are being dumped into the American environment and bloodstream and everything else, that we should be looking instead at doing it like in Europe, where there's maybe 5,000 or 6,000 chemicals, and the chemical industry that supports you has to prove that the chemicals are safe before
they have. They're starting a regulation now that is going to address close to 100,000 chemicals. So to say that they only have 6,000 chemicals is absurd.
Okay.
And the other thing is, you have to remember that, you know, chemicals provide benefits in society. You can get rid of chlorine, but you can also have lots of people dying from dirty water.
From dysentery, certainly. I agree with you. Are you suggesting that the precautionary principle is not in use in Europe?
No. You know what? You can. How you define it is a big question. The thing is, the precautionary principle is usually a political terminology used to basically justify taking anything off the market for any good, for any reason.
Okay.
It's a political term.
Angela, let's take a few calls here. I get your point. Anthony in Pennsylvania has a question for you. Anthony, you're live with Angela Logomassini of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Hi. I don't have any question like yet, but I would like to convey a message here or a comment that I'm in Pennsylvania, and I graduated high school in 1974, and we're in our late 40s right now. And for my graduating class in the area of Pennsylvania, who we know there are definitely high risks of cancer and cancer-related illnesses, I know at least 10 people, including two relatives, that are dead right now from cancer and cancer-related illnesses. So I don't know where your statistics are from or what you're doing or your agendas or anything like that, but I have to wholeheartedly disagree with what you're trying to, you know, feed us right now. Stuff like that. With all due respect, though, and, you know, you can go on and comment and stuff like that, but you're not going to get me to be a believer of any of that kind of stuff, including my sister, too.
Got it. Thank you, Anthony. Angela?
Well, certainly people know lots of people who have been sick and have cancer. And
yeah. Anecdotal reports.
Situations, whether or not that is a trend related to chemicals, whether or not this is it's going up in the population, that's something for scientific study, and I'm simply reporting what the National Cancer Institute has reported.
Could you tell me what the date was on that study, please?
They do it every year.
The one that you've been citing, I'd like to look it up.
Well, I have looked at a bunch of them in the recent years. I can send you the links to them if you'd like.
Are they on your website?
They're not on our website. They're on the National Cancer Institute website. I thought go get them, and I can actually send you. I can probably send you PDFs. No problem.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Sure.
All righty. Angela Logomassini, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Angela, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
I do appreciate it, your willingness to be out there.
Okay.
Okay. Have a good one. The Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. In fact, cancer rates in the United States are dropping largely as a result of a reduction in smoking. At the same time here now, mothers pass on hundreds of chemicals from pesticides to flame retardants to their babies through their umbilical cords, according to a groundbreaking study. This from an article by Colleen Diskin in the, it's been syndicated all over the United States. The study released this month found 287 industrial chemicals and pollutants in umbilical cord blood in 10 babies born in U.S. hospitals. The blood harbored pesticides, chemicals from nonstick cooking pans and plastic wrap, long-band PCBs, and wastes from burning coal, gasoline, and garbage. On average, each baby had been exposed to 200 chemicals. Scientists have long cautioned expectant mothers to limit their exposure to chemicals by avoiding mercury-tainted fish, for example, and staying out of the nursery until the paint is dry. But the study, paid for by the Washington-based Environmental Working Group, is the first to examine the sheer number of exposures infants can have via the umbilical cord from pollutants that are nearly impossible for their mothers to avoid, the researchers said. So, and on it goes. Jeff in Denver on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Well, throughout history, we've had a used chemicals in ways now that are really laughable, such as, you know, in the Queen Elizabeth's time, they used to wash their face in products with, you know, had mercury, get their, take off their makeup and so forth that way, and, you know, their faces used to fall off.
Right.
We've
done
things with mercury, lead, arsenic, where we used to put them in our bodies.
Yeah, and I would say Angela's point is, and we don't anymore.
Yeah, but we're doing something with phthalates, you know, plastic softeners and so forth. That we honestly don't know about their estrogen mimics and so forth.
Yeah.
And many would attribute the longer lifespan, which they keep on talking about, or medicine doing it, actually to improvements in sanitation more than anything else.
But then the other side would say, and a lot of those improvements in sanitation have to do with the use of chemicals like disinfectants.
Well, but their sanitation mostly is talking about sewage and stuff like that. That's, we've gotten rid of things like cholera and so forth by improving our sewer system. As far as dealing with chlorine, yes, chlorine is important as for the transport of water, but we should be filtering out the other end. We're doing a great experiment of the world right now of putting chlorine in our lawns and so forth. Chlorine is used because it kills things, and we're spreading it all over the planet. We don't know what it does.
We know some of the things that it does, and it forms compounds that can be very carcinogenic, absolutely. And you know, one of the reasons why people are drinking bottled water increasingly. But it's an interesting debate. And on the one hand, it is horrific. In my mind, the level of exposure of chemicals that we're experiencing, and the fact that so few of them have been carefully studied. On the other hand, people are living longer. On the third hand, if you have three hands, why are people living longer? Number one, in large part, people have stopped smoking. Number two, our diets perhaps have improved, although it looks like the trends may be reversing. Look at what's happening with obesity.
Yeah.
I don't think people are going to be living longer in 15 or 20 years as a result of that.
But are we living longer well?
Right. And there's that issue as well. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Mike in Pittsburgh, you're on the line. Hey, Mike.
How you doing? I have a question. A large number of people I've known, or at least I've read about, in their 30s and 40s are getting cancer, different types of cancers, not, you know, one specific type. Do you think, I don't know if there's any studies done on that to see if there's a larger number of 40-year-olds getting hit with cancer, or 50-year-olds or 30-year-olds or what
have you? I'm going to have to do my homework on this, and I'm sorry to have brought Michelle on without having done that, because the whole issue of cancer and longevity is a really complex one, I want to track down somebody who's an expert on this thing and get them on here rather than just, you know, a flack for a PR company, which is basically what the competitive enterprise is a company that's a front group for some very wealthy and powerful conservative families, and a whole lot of companies like Philip Morris, Ford Motor Company, CSX, Texaco, Dow Chemical, ARCO Foundation, Cigna, in General Motors, and so on. My apologies for not having tracked down all those details in advance.
Sure, I understand.
Next time, I will.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mike. Good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Say what you want, mean what you say. Remember the deepest seeds till the final light of day. Do as you please.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Mark Carlin is with us. It's our best of the rest of the news segment. Mark is the editor and founder and chief cook and bottle washer there. You have an official title at BuzzFlash.com, Mark?
Yep.
Got to push the button. Hey, Mark, I'm sorry. You weren't on the air. There you go. What's your title there at BuzzFlash?
Editor and publisher.
Editor and publisher. Great. Okay. You guys have, I want to talk in general about what's going on in the news here this over this last week. This is what we generally do with our Best of the Rest of the News segment this hour in the program. However, you folks have made a specific prediction in the last week. You've really climbed out on a limb here, and you've done it based on some historical information that I think most Americans are completely ignorant about, and I want to get into that with you. First of all, your prediction.
We predict that Bush Jr. will file a Bush Sr., and if indictments do come down against Karl Rove, and it probably will not just be him but other senior staffers, and there's always the possibility that Bush may be considered a co-conspirator in this Treasongate case because he did hire a personal attorney. We predict that he will follow Bush Sr., who pardoned, and we're looking at a New York Times cover story that we have reposted on BuzzFlash, and what it says is Bush pardoned six in Iran affair, averting a Weinberger trial, prosecutor assails cover-up. And we predict that who we call Baby Doc Bush will pardon anyone indicted on the White House staff ahead of prosecution in order to avoid Baby Doc Bush being drawn into the Treasongate affair. That is to say, what Papa Bush did with Weinberger was he was indicted by the independent counsel.
He being Casper Weinberger, who at the time was
Secretary of Defense.
Right.
And under Ronald Reagan. And he pardoned him prior to
trial. Hang on just a second. He was indicted for what?
The Iran-Contra affair, which, of course, Ollie North and John Poindexter were convicted on, and then their convictions were overturned by Judge David Sentell and Lauren Silberman, who sat on the U.S. District Court of Appeals. And David Sentell is basically a Republican partisan hack. He's sort of the zealot federal activist Republican judge who seems to just show up every time there's a crucial decision involving a key Republican. And the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. hears many of these cases because it's the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And, of course, many of these federal cases, including Treasongate and the Clinton case in terms of Kenneth Starr, are heard in D.C. by D.C. Grand juries. So Weinberger was pardoned. What's key here to remember, Tom, is Papa Bush pardoned Weinberger in advance of a trial. He was indicted, but he was never tried. And the concern of Papa Bush was that Weinberger might cop a plea, or as is often used the term, plea bargain, and turn state's evidence against Senior Bush himself, who was clearly involved quite intimately with the Iran-Contra affair.
And the part of Iran-Contra that I think Bush Sr. had most to be worried about is outlined in Joseph Trento's new book on the CIA. We had Joe on the program yesterday at some length. And that is his negotiations, along with Bill Casey, with the Iranians while Jimmy Carter was still president, that if they would hold the hostages until the elections, thus devastating Jimmy Carter in the polls, so that Bush and Reagan would become vice president and president, then they would sell weapons to the Iranians. And in fact, they did. They followed through on their promise. And the Iranians released the hostages as Ronald Reagan's hand was put on the Bible in January of 1981. And immediately we started selling, well, not immediately, but shortly thereafter, we started selling weapons to them illegally. And Bush Sr. was involved in engineering this whole thing. And this may be what he was afraid would come out, do you think?
It's not only that. We have to remember that George Bush Sr., I mean, these are not wild conspiracy theories. These are facts. Bush Sr. was head of the CIA. The CIA is named after, the CIA building is named after George Herbert Walker Bush. That is the name of the CIA building in Langley, Virginia. This is no conspiracy theory. He was head of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he was a CIA agent for a while. One of his, again, this is factual. This is not, again, coming out of some message from Mars or something. And he was involved early on in his career in recruiting anti-Castro agents and many South American agents. And many of the key people involved in Iran-Contra were people who actually had contacts with George Herbert Walker Bush Sr. when he was a CIA operative. And again, these are not loony kind of conspiracy theories. This is just all fact. And one of the people, indeed, who is the person who was responsible for bringing crack cocaine to Los Angeles, as uncovered in a San Jose Mercury news story, the author of which, who committed suicide earlier this year, was a person who knew George Herbert Walker Bush, and part of that money was traced back to the Iran, through a complicated series of transactions through the Iran-Contra affair. So let's just say that Caspar Weinberger, as Secretary of Defense, was in a position to drop the bag probably on George Herbert Walker Bush in a number of ways. And Lawrence Walsh, who was the independent counsel, was absolutely furious because it was one thing to pardon someone who's been convicted. It's another to pardon someone in advance of a trial. And so Weinberger was never, the American public never had the opportunity to hear his testimony about Iran-Contra and the prosecution's case against Weinberger, which in many ways clearly implicated George Herbert Walker Bush in the Iran-Contra affair. But I think it's also important to point out, because when we deal with issues like this, the interrelationships, that it was a technicality on which the convictions, and they were tried and convicted, of John Poindexter and Oliver North on Iran-Contra were overturned, of double jeopardy, which was in essence that because they had testified before Congress, the David Sentell, who again is a Republican hack judge who was still around doing mischief and in relation to approving all sorts of executive privileges and secret searches and so forth for the executive branch. David, and he is, by the way, David Sentell is, by the way, and again, this is not, Tom, conspiracy theory from Buzzflash.
Right, this is stuff that's not even being disputed.
No, this is all on the record, factual information. This is not conjecture. David Sentell was the person who met with Jesse Helms and former senator from North Carolina, Lawrence Faircloth, and removed special prosecutor or independent counsel Fisk, who had been doing the Whitewater investigation, was about to close it up, saying there was nothing there. And Jesse Helms was so upset that they weren't going to find anything that the Clintons were guilty of that they removed Fisk, who was about to just close up the whole operation of the independent counsel on the Clintons, and placed Ken Starr in that position. That was the same David Sentell who overturned the convictions of Ollie North and John Poindexter on this technicality.
Okay, so this happened on the Bush Sr. administration. So the bottom line here, just to boil this down, is that Bush Sr., some of his underlings who were involved in criminal enterprises that he was apparently involved in were indicted, and there were several of them, and including Cap Weinberger, and they would have had to testify in open court. It would have then put the president and the vice president, certainly the vice president, possibly even Ronald Reagan himself, probably even Reagan, it at least would have revealed the fact that he had Alzheimer's at that point, or worse, it would have revealed the fact that he was complicit in crimes. It was putting the presidency at risk, and so they pardoned these guys in advance. And you're suggesting that if George W. Bush is involved in this thing, that he's going to do the same thing with Turd Blossom, with his affectionate name for Karl Rove, that he's going to pardon him in advance.
Well, Bush is certainly running around smiling, and Karl Rove, you know, is still attached at the hip with Bush. Bush goes to great lengths to appear walking to air to the helicopter that will take him to Air Force One with Karl Rove, and Karl Rove is in on key meetings. I mean, if Bush got rid of Karl Rove, it would be akin to performing a self lobotomy.
Yeah.
So, yes, we have written several editorials and news analysis, and we have a reader who is a regular contributor who wrote a long piece basically saying that Judge Roberts is also potentially part of this. Now, this gets into conspiracy theory or potential conspiracy theory. I don't want to say this is fact. I want to be clear about that with Judge Roberts. But the point is, would this become a constitutional issue if Rove and others are indicted, Scooter Libby and maybe some others, including people who are in the Iran working group, which this seems to have come out of the outing of Valerie Plame.
Now, I'm sorry.
If they were indicted and then Bush pardoned them in advance of a trial, and the special prosecutor, who is really, that term is misleading because he was appointed by John Ashcroft, Patrick Fitzgerald, but he still works for the Department of Justice.
Right.
He doesn't really have the independent status of the special prosecutor. He could be fired at any time, just as Archibald Cox was under Nixon.
I was just going to say, as Nixon tried to do. Or did.
But if Fitzgerald was not fired and then chose to challenge Bush on the pardoning of these people who betrayed the country in order to save Bush's own neck, and he challenged this in the court, and Judge Roberts went to the Supreme Court, and Judge Roberts on the Supreme Court, would he rule with Bush, as Sandra Day O'Connell did in the 2000 election, or would he uphold the law of the land and say that Bush and these other people, like anyone else, are subject to the rule of law and that they should have their day in court and not be preemptively pardoned in order to keep the American people from knowing the truth about who betrayed the nation, outed a CIA agent, and endangered our national security,
right,
which may very well include and de facto is condoned. I mean, this again is not conspiracy theory. Clearly this has been condoned by President Bush because he's done absolutely nothing about it, even though now we know that Karl Rove at a minimum confirmed Hearst Edis as a CIA operative. And more than that, that Scooter Libby also did, and that there's a hornet's nest of betrayal in the White House, and Bush is supporting all these people. So de facto, he's condoned it. Whether or not he actually gave them the green light and was notified of it is what we don't know
yet.
Well,
here's the thing that baffles me, Mark Carlin, and we only have about 2 minutes left. A week or so ago, it was reported in the press that the memo from the State Department that Colin Powell had asked for the day of Joe Wilson's article in the New York Times that basically said, who the hell is this guy? You know, where did he come from? What's up with him? The memo that described Joe Wilson and mentioned the fact that his wife worked for the CIA that was marked top secret, and the paragraph about his wife was marked do not disclose even to foreign intelligence agencies. That memo went from the State Department to Air Force One. On Air Force One, you had Ari Fleischer, Colin Powell, and George W. Bush. Within hours of the time that was received on Air Force One, as these guys were flying to Africa, a few hours later, Scooter Libby and Karl Rove are dialing for dollars. They're calling reporters to out Valerie Plame. I don't believe that Colin Powell would have had the authority to call the president's assistant or the vice president's assistant and say, assassinate this guy politically. Nor do I think Colin Powell would have had the inclination, but I don't think I think that's above his pay grade. Certainly, Ari Fleischer wouldn't have had the authority to do that. That leaves George W. Bush. And that story has vanished from the media. Why?
I think because, as we know in an editorial, Rove is a master at creating a banality of treason, we called it. He changes the subject. They announce Roberts prematurely. And they lie so boldly and so brazenly that it defies common sense. That is to say, someone out in Kansas would say, well, the president wouldn't do something like that. I mean, look, he just nominated this nice man for a Supreme Court. That's some Tom Hartman crazy conspiracy theory. I think it is essential to understanding the Bush administration that they get away with such audacious lying that you seem like a fringe conspiracist in calling them on their lies, because no one could believe they would lie that boldly. Look at Bolton, who's just been exposed as lying to the Senate in terms of whether he was interviewed or not, on Treasongate. He lied. He just lied. He said no. On a written questionnaire.
Right, and today they said, oh, he made a mistake.
He made a mistake, and by all accounts, he's going to be appointed as a recess appointment next week or the week following.
Remarkable. You can learn more about it at BuzzFlash.com. Mark Carlin, the publisher and senior editor or editor-in-chief there at BuzzFlash.com. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Keep up the great work. It's one of the best sites on the Internet. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's the Tom Hartman Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within.
And welcome back, my friends. I've been poking around here on the web looking at cancer and chemicals and all this sort of thing. I'm it's making me crazy here. Yes, cancer rates are down largely because people are not smoking as much as they were. Cancer rates are up substantially in some groups where smoking is up. But the big issue with environmental chemicals, it turns out, is breast and ovarian cancer rates have increased. Exposure to endocrine-disrupting chemicals may be responsible for a 400% increase in ectopic or tubal pregnancies. Adolescents experience a delay in the onset of puberty in some cases or an increase in the onset of puberty. Men are experiencing a 50% reduction in sperm count over the last 50 years. And much of this seems to be tracking back to chemicals in our environment. So I walked into, in our first segment of our program, the classic trap of look it, there's a boat over there, therefore there's no car here. I mean, it was apples and oranges. We'll deal with that in more detail as time goes on. Crash Cough from the chat room is on the line, 1-866-889-8894 on the telephone. Hey, what's up?
Hi, Tom, how are you?
I'm well, what's up?
It's an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
Hey, I had a question. Has anybody asked Colin Powell if he briefed Bush on this memo? I've been waiting for an interview in a newspaper or some news report saying that, yes, Colin Powell says he did or he denies that he did.
I guarantee you Colin Powell is not talking. You know, I can guarantee you the guy's a good soldier. I mean, he's a good soldier for the Republican Party, even though he's been trashed by Bush, even though his leaving, his son who got the plum job at the FCC was in part, you know, the payoff for his coming on as Secretary of State and giving his political capital to George Bush. He's not gonna betray Bush.
Okay. Has he been subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know, and I haven't seen that in any news reports. And of course, the grand jury actions are confidential.
Right.
So you know, we may never find out until indictments come down. Presumably, this is all going to wrap up by the end of October, and it's gonna be real interesting to see how it comes out.
Thanks
a lot for the call. Good to hear from
you. Bye
bye. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
been listening to the Tom Hartman Program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org, podcast at Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Karen Wayland is with us. Karen is the legislative director for the National Resource Defense Council and one of the most knowledgeable people about the energy bill that was just passed. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Can I just correct you? It's Natural Resources Defense Council.
Oh, thank you. You're right. So it is. The Natural Resource Defense Council. And tell us about the energy bill. What do Americans need to know that they don't know?
Well, Congress has been working on this energy bill for somewhere around 5 years, and you know they've had 5 years to address our country's most pressing energy needs, and they have failed on all accounts. We've got increasing oil dependence, high gas prices. We've got destructive energy development, giant subsidies for polluters. We're experiencing the effects of global warming already, and not one of these problems is really addressed in the energy bill that both the House and the Senate have just passed in a couple days. So, you know, because Congress blew it, we're going to remain dependent on oil, and we'll keep paying high prices at the pump.
Okay, Ed, that sounds then that it's a net neutral, that things are just going to, the status quo is going to be maintained. But I suspect it's really not a net neutral.
I think it's worse than neutral for a lot of reasons. One is that it misses huge opportunities. Congress writes energy legislation maybe once every 10 to 15 years. We can't wait 10 to 15 years to reduce our emissions of carbon that contribute to global warming. We can't wait 10 to 15 years to reduce our dependence on oil, and we certainly can't wait 10 years to keep doling out all of our taxpayer dollars when we've got huge deficits to polluting industries that are receiving record profits. So I think that it's worse than neutral, and we're not even talking about sort of the irreversible damage that will be done as a result of some of the exemptions to our environmental and public health laws that are contained in this bill.
Karen Whalen, one of the buzz phrases these days, one of the hot topics is clean coal, in quotes. And there's, you know, the industry has launched a multi-million-dollar advertising campaign. There's a huge PR campaign. There's discussion in a number of states about building new clean coal power plants. What is clean coal power? Well, first of all, what is it?
Well, the idea is that instead of burning coal as chunks of coal, that the process would convert the coal into natural gas, and then the natural gas would be burned instead to generate power.
This is called gasification.
Gasification. And it is true that burning natural gas is cleaner than burning coal, but you still get huge emissions of particulate matter and other pollutants that create smog and ozone. And we also still have the problem of emission of carbon dioxide that contributes to global warming. So what NRDC was hoping to see was, you know, we recognize that we can't turn the switch off on coal. Coal is going to be part of our energy mix for many years to come. But what we were hoping to see is that these new power plants that are being discussed include a way to capture the carbon and store it in deep underground reservoirs. And that's really not part of what's in the subsidies for the new coal plants in the energy bill.
Is that technology, well, actually, before we get to that, in order to gasify coal, I'm assuming that they have to somehow crush it and heat it. Is that right?
That's part of it, yes.
Okay. How much, you know, what's the net loss of energy? Is it 10% less efficient, 5%, 30%?
Oh,
I mean, how much energy is used to gasify coal before they burn the gas?
That is an engineering question that I don't have the answer for, but I can tell you that it is something that we think is worth investigating because it is a way to keep coal in the mix while we transition to different energy sources.
Yeah.
But it has to be done right, and the way the energy bill is doing it is, we believe, is not the way to go.
Okay, so we have the byproducts. First of all, there's the combustion byproducts, just mm-hmm. the ash and the, you know, all that kind of thing.
Right.
Secondly, there's the byproduct of carbon dioxide. And then third, if you're gasifying the coal and you're burning the gas, then presumably there's a lot of physical matter of sludge or solids that are left over from that process.
I think you're right. And if you look at the life cycle of coal, you've got to mine it too. And what we're seeing in the Appalachians is this terrible problem of mountaintop removal, where they go in
right.
and they blast the top of the mountains off, take that fill and put it into streams and rivers, and then start mining. So it is a destructive way to get our energy, and we'd like to see our economy rely much more on clean, renewable sources of energy and on energy efficiency.
Yeah. You mentioned capturing carbon dioxide and storing it underground. Is there a technology for that that's actually viable right now?
They are doing lots of research, and it's looking like it's a very promising technique, and I believe there is one plant out there that is doing that right now.
The Bush administration has spent a lot of time and money in changing and attempting to change, with their Clear Skies Initiative, the rules regarding scrubbers. And if power plants upgrade or if they increase in size, it used to be under the Clinton administration rules, they had to increase also, they had to bring themselves up to the modern standards for air pollution, for reducing air pollution. Bush, of course, has rolled those back. To what extent can scrubbing be done nowadays?
Well, it actually can be done quite effectively.
And how far are we from what should be done?
Well, the technology is out there to clean up emissions from power plants. It absolutely is out there. But you're right that it is not on most power plants, because they haven't installed, these are older power plants, and they haven't installed these new scrubbers. What the Bush administration has been trying to do with its quote-unquote Clear Skies Act is to exempt those older power plants from adding those scrubbers when they go through upgrades. And we've been very fortunate over the past couple years to have been able to block that Clear Skies initiative in the Senate. And so the Bush administration hasn't been able to actually enact in law the changes that they'd like to see in the Clean Air Act.
Yeah, I find it really quite remarkable how Orwellian they are with their language. Really.
Yeah, we've been calling it the Dirty Skies Act.
Yeah.
Because it will result in more pollution over longer periods of time.
Yeah. So what are the options for the United States? Are we in a position right now where it would be possible, for example, for communities to generate their own electricity and not have to depend on centralized utilities? Is it possible for individual homes to generate their own electricity and not even depend on community systems? If so, what kind of costs are involved? What's the state of the art of the technology right now?
Well, there are homes out there in the United States that are what we call off the grid, so they're generating their own power. Some of them are even off the grid in terms of the water infrastructure, too. They're out there, but they're very rare. And, in fact, we don't think that they necessarily have to stay off the grid. We think that that electric utilities can do a fair job of generating their electricity with renewable sources and using centralized facilities to generate electricity that then can be distributed to homes using the infrastructure, the wires, the telephone poles that are out there right now. So,
but why do that if in distribution? I mean, the last estimate I saw was that 15-17% of all electricity generated in the United States is lost in transmission lines, simply, converted into heat as it inductively coupled out of the transmission lines as it's moved around the United States. Why even do that? Why have a situation like that if it's possible to locally generate electricity and not have these long line losses? Not to mention the fact that there's concerns about high tension lines causing leukemia. The need to spray chemicals to keep down plants may be a problem. Eminent domain, you're taking up people's land. They're unsightly. They're dangerous. I mean, why not go for more community-based alternatives?
Well, I think, you're asking some very specific questions on sort of the electric utility sector that I, as the legislative director, are probably not that qualified to answer. But I think that what we are seeing, because the federal government has failed to take action on a lot of these pressing energy needs, is that the energy revolution actually is happening at the local level. So we're seeing states enact changes to their energy policies. We're seeing local communities do that, maybe change their building codes and to have more energy efficient buildings. So I agree that things are happening at the local level, but I cannot give you the exact specifics on, you know, what the costs are to build
right,
a house.
I understand.
That's totally off the grid.
As the legislative director, what do you see as the future of legislation for clean energy, renewable energy in the United States? What's it going to take to bring about change? Is it just a matter of if we vote all the Republicans out of office, then everything will be solved, or are we then going to end up with a bunch of Democrats who are in the pockets of the big oil industry?
If you look at the vote in the House and the Senate, I cannot blame the passage of this bad energy bill just on Republicans, because there were plenty of Republicans who crossed the party line to vote against this bad bill, and there were plenty of Democrats who supported the bad bill. So it really is a matter of who they're listening to. 92% of the American people are concerned about our dependence on oil. During this whole energy bill debate, you heard a chorus of voices, whether it was from, you know, environmentalists or from the conservative national security experts, saying that we need a new energy policy. And yet this energy bill is not new energy policy. And so, you know, you look at all the billions of dollars that are going to the oil and gas companies, the coal companies, and the nuclear industry, and the millions of dollars that all those industries put into the election campaigns. And I think it's clear, if you follow the traces of money, you know, how the decisions were made to write this energy bill.
Yeah. Now, Jimmy Carter, back a year before the end of his presidency, gave a speech in which he said that we would never again use more oil, more foreign oil, than we had used in 1978, that he was going to absolutely declare war on the use of increased use of foreign oil, and that by the year 2000, we would use 20% of our electricity would be generated by the sun, by solar power. And he put a series of initiatives in place to make that happen. Number one, what happened to those? And number two, how can we bring back that kind of a vision in the United States? And we have about a minute left. I'm sorry, Kim.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Well, I can tell you that we haven't seen any increases in fuel efficiency since then. And so we've had, you know, close to 30 years, a generation of people driving around in cars where the fuel efficiency has been getting worse and worse and worse. So since Carter, we haven't seen a great willpower at the federal level to do the things necessary to really shift our energy economy away from, you know, dirty polluting fuels. And what will it take? It will take the American people really waking up and taking action with their elected officials and holding them accountable for things like passing this dirty energy bill.
And CAFE standards, do you see any changes there?
Not in the near future. The Congress voted down every attempt this time around to increase fuel efficiency standards, even when it was proposed to increase them 1 mile per gallon per year. That was voted down. So a very
incredible.
Modest. Yeah.
And it seems like the car companies could actually use that as a good excuse to start producing the kind of cars that people actually want to buy. I mean,
exactly.
It's a year and a half waiting list to get a Prius right now here in Oregon. And it's,
exactly.
It's amazing. Dr. Karen Wayland, the Legislative Director of the National Resources Defense Council, www.nrdc.org. Karen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I do appreciate it. Keep up the great work.
Thanks.
It's 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What's wrong with this picture? There's something I'm not seeing here.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes past the hour. Our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. On the web, tomhartman.com. You can get there and drop into our live chat room if you'd like. Ann Coulter, yesterday, talking to Oliver Wills. Thought this was fascinating. We have the media. Just get
Sam,
this.
And there's a difference between this Senate today and the Senate in 1991.
This is not a debate that's going to be decided in the court of public opinion. This is a debate that's going to be decided by 100 senators. And you know as well as I know that this 100 senators is made up of an almost totally unified Democratic Party and a Republican Party that's in shambles, that's afraid of its own shadows. They're not going to fight for Clarence Thomas the way they did in 1991. It's a shameful situation, but there you have it.
And
I think they would. I think it's a better Senate than it was then. And we have the media now.
Interesting. And you've got, like, you know, for example, Tom Friedman saying, you know, nothing to worry about. We just toss him in jail. You know, maybe we should just keep a list of all these people. And then, of course, Bill O'Reilly completely agreeing with that.
Because you must know the difference between dissent from the Iraq War and the War on Terror and undermining it. And any American that undermines that war with our soldiers in the field or undermines the War on Terror with 3,000 dead on 9/11 is a traitor.
Now, they're not calling it the War on Terror anymore, Bill. I'm sorry. It's called the Global Conflict Against Extremism or Extremists, sort of like Bill Frist extremists, I suppose. But in any case, he continues.
Everybody got it? Dissent? Fine. Undermining? You're a traitor.
Aha, there you go. And so if you're undermining, you're in deep trouble. Yep, and
got it. So all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they're undermining everything.
Yeah. And then we have Thomas Friedman, the guy who brought us globalization, with his book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree. I mean, pretty much brought us globalization. Thomas Friedman has been the champion of this stuff, of global so-called free trade. It's called free trade even though there's thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of minutia and rules and details in the World Trade Agreements, World Trade Organization's documents that bring it about. Thomas Friedman coming along saying that we should be keeping a list. Keeping a list, as Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting points out, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman has urged the U.S. government to create blacklists of condemned political speech, not only by those who advocate violence, but by those who believe the U.S. government actions may encourage violent reprisals. In other words, if you say that you think that George Bush's misguided policies in Iraq have caused there to be more terrorism in the world, which, by the way, happens to be what the Central Intelligence Agency is saying. If you say that, according to Thomas Friedman, the government should be putting your name on a list. We should be watching you. Or, as Bill O'Reilly said, we should be taking you away in chains. They went on to point out, Friedman's column urged the government to create quarterly wit lists of hate mongers and excuse makers. Excuse makers, as well as what he called truth tellers, Muslims who agree with Friedman's critique of Islam. So if you agree with Thomas Friedman, the government should put you on a truth teller list. If you disagree, you should be on a hate monger list. If you disagree and you have logic behind you, you should be on an excuse makers list. I got to tell you, this reminds me, when I lived in Germany back in the 80s and talked with people who lived through the Holocaust, who lived through the Hitler time in Germany, and I knew a number of these elderly folks, one of the early things Hitler did was he created denunciations, this program where you could call your local radio station and turn in your neighbors on the air. Thomas Friedman, one step away from it, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate, and to discriminate only generates hate.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Greg Gorman is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Tom, can I just say you have great taste in music? The Black Eyed Peas are one of my favorite groups.
Well, good. Thank you very much. Thank you. Actually, the tip of the hat should go to Louise, who selects our bumper music. So
well, please tell Louise that's one of my favorite songs by one of my favorite groups.
I'll do it. She done good. So what's happening in Washington, D.C.? They're in the belly of the beast there, Greg.
Well, we are having one conversation and one conversation only today at the gaggle and the briefing, and that is about Senator Frist and his flip-flop on stem cell research. The White House press corps was in a feeding frenzy, if you can call it that, on the last day before vacation, about if the president and Senator Frist are at odds, what did the president tell the senator? According to Scott McClellan, the senator came to the White House and spoke to the president and told him about his plans to change his opinion on embryonic stem cell research, and the president said, quote, "You have to vote with your conscience. I understand." But of course, what people are really saying is, look, is the president being left behind?
What if, Greg, the president went to Bill Frist and said, you know, this memo that was prepared by the State Department that listed, that named Valerie Plame, this top secret memo, was sent to Air Force One, and it was me and Colin Powell and Ari Fleischer were the only ones on that plane. And within hours of getting that memo onto Air Force One, my assistant, Carl Rove, and my vice president's assistant, Scooter Libby, started dialing for dollars, calling journalists. And people are starting to figure out that Ari Fleischer didn't have the authority to order my assistant and Cheney's assistant to do this, to commit treason. And they're figuring out that Colin Powell didn't even have the authority to do that. And, you know, the story's been floating around in the news, and it's getting some traction on the web that maybe George W. Bush, maybe I'm involved in this thing. And we tried to deflect the attention with this Supreme Court nomination, and it really didn't do a good job. So why don't you come out in favor of stem cells? We can have a nice fight in the media, and it'll deflect everybody's attention from whether or not I, George W. Bush, am a traitor to the United States.
You know what? I can boost that up a little bit if you want me to.
Go for it.
So Scott McClellan today, you know, it's the last day before vacation. Everyone's leaving, and Congress is on recess, and the president's going to Crawford on Tuesday. He's going to take all these weeks off. He was so angry today. He literally was shouting people down because what the press was asking is, look, what we're trying to say is, is the president in support of embryonic stem cell research, and is this a flip-flop on Senator Frist? And Scott McClellan just was throwing his hands up, saying, why do you not want to talk about what we've done in the last few weeks? Why do you not want to talk about how important we've been this week and what we've done for the American people? And 2 months ago, we were a lame duck, according to you, and now all of a sudden, you know, we're getting things done for the country, and this has been a very important week, and no one will talk about it. And he was so angry, and it was so out of the blue. He was obviously playing into that, all that rhetoric of trying to say, look, the president has done so many things this week.
Did anybody
and now
ask
we're so
him
angry about Bill Frist.
Did anybody ask him about Treasongate?
We know Treasongate is gone by the wayside, just like you said,
because of Bill Frist.
Because of Bill, and that's what I said yesterday. Someone else, I'm saying it now, we're talking about one thing and one thing only, and it's Bill Frist.
Yeah, interesting. Now, I'm wondering if the president giving the finger and that being publicized by Jay Leno on national TV yesterday.
Let me tell you the funny story about that.
Yeah, what happened there?
So this morning, well, what happened was when the president was meeting with Republican leaders and Republican members of Congress a few days ago on the Hill, he was asked a question by the press corps, who was kept at arm's length. You know, someone shouted a question at the president, what do you think about CAFTA, which now we know passed by 2 votes. According to the White House, according to Scott McClellan, the president kind of gave a backwards thumbs up, meaning, yes, we're good. Of course, it looked like something else.
A backwards thumbs up with his middle finger?
Well, exactly. And so Scott McClellan yesterday, ironically, in the briefing, said that he would dignify that with a response. Now, today, this morning, in the gaggle, whenever the press walked in, it was one of the first questions. As soon as Scott walked into the briefing room, about 15 journalists in the room all gave Scott the thumbs up. And everybody cracked up. It was very, very funny.
Yeah, but, well, this is not...
And he said it was his thumb.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. According to the White House, this was his thumb. He knows the president. He knows how the president acts. And this is absolutely preposterous, to quote Scott McClellan.
Yeah, well, at least that's not treason. I mean, you know, frankly, if the president gives the press the finger, that doesn't bother me. What bothers me is that the president got a memo saying that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA. That memo made its way to a bunch of reporters, including Bob Novak, who outed her and brought down a counterterrorism operation that might have led to things like the bombings in London, the bombings in Spain, the death of Americans all around the world, the compromising of CIA operations. It might have made our country less secure. This guy may have committed treason against the United States of America for purely political purposes, and instead we're talking about stem cell research and whether or not he gave somebody the finger. That's what bothers me.
It bothers me as well. We keep talking about how the press has such a short attention span and how we this and how we that. And what you're saying is exactly right. Why did we allow ourselves to be diverted off of the CIA leak and Rove and Libby and Card and Gonzalez and all these guys who are high up in the administration who had a non-refutable link to this leak?
We got to get a press corps here, Greg, that can chew gum and talk and walk at the same time.
That's right.
There's more than one issue.
That's right. Everyone has ADD around the Washington press corps these days.
It seems to be. Okay. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service. Greg, thanks for the report today from Washington.
Tom, always good to be with you.
Always good talking with you and hanging out with you. Thanks, Greg. Good to have you here. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Ed and San Juan Capistrano on the line. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Treason. Oh, my goodness. There's other stuff to pay attention to.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's treason.
I mean, it is significant that Bill Frist flip-flopped on this thing. And, you know, we can do a lot of speculation about it. But the thing is, he did it. The timing was just absolutely perfect. Because if Bill Frist hadn't flip-flopped on this, the Supreme Court thing with John Roberts is going nowhere in terms of the media. And I guarantee you that the Sunday morning talk shows had already booked guests to discuss Treasongate. And now Bill Frist has given the president a marvelous gift in changing the subject.
Isn't that amazing? Well, I've got one. I want to be positive to you, Tom, because you face negativity all day long. Yesterday you had a guest on who said that we should face, well, if we poor people need stuff, we should go to charity.
Right.
And he could hardly say it. He was choking it out. Charity?
Okay.
Well, I found out a big corporation that gives us charity.
Yeah.
And it was just brought to my attention the other day, and I'm going to try to go up there and spend the night tonight, hopefully, with my wife. Walmart allows the homeless to stay in their parking lots overnight for free.
The homeless?
I
knew that Walmart allowed people with RVs to sleep.
Oh, RVs, yes, but now it's being filled. And a friend of mine is staying there because he just lost his home. They're staying there. Fathers, mothers, and kids in the back of their trucks and stuff. That's not camping, Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of them are homeless. Well, thank you, Walmart.
Well, actually,
God bless you.
You know, hang on just a second here, Ed. Is this some sort of policy of Walmart's?
I guess so.
I mean, this place
you can always pull in and sleep.
That's interesting. I'd like to learn more about that because most stores, of course, won't allow that. Well,
yeah,
you know,
they
it's a sad
you.
Commentary.
The cops move them.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Not at Walmart because they're allowed to go in late at night and do their little grocery shopping, and then in the mornings and stuff like that to use bathrooms. But it's being more and more of those charity people, those homeless people. Isn't that great?
Well. You know, it's a sad commentary on things, but...
Isn't it, though? Do you remember Senior was running the government and there was homeless all over the place?
Yeah. Well, that
could
was...
be happening again?
Yeah, I remember before Reagan when you never saw homeless people, but, you know,
so
that's...
Why,
you know, I remember an America that wasn't like today, but most folks alive today, I think, are probably younger than you and I, Ed, and they don't remember those things.
Hey, see you at Walmart.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Ed. Thanks for the call. It's... I want to go back to this thing about Thomas Friedman. Thomas Friedman's suggestion that the government should be compiling lists. And what I want to share with you is from Milton Mayer. Milton Mayer was a Jewish American writer. He lived in Chicago actually. And after World War II, he was curious, how could it be that the Germans just, you know, went along with this, that they bought into this, that the average German, you know, he in his mind couldn't wrap his mind around the idea that all Germans were evil people and that they all became, or that all Germans were Nazis. And yet there was the Holocaust, you know, 5-6 million people put to death. Well, many more than that, actually, by the Nazis, certainly 6 million Jews put to death by the Nazis. And how did this happen? And so he went over to Germany and he spent about a year and a half there interviewing, getting to know quite well, actually, a number of Germans, a few of them Jewish, but most of them Catholic or Protestant, Christian Germans who were just, you know, your average person. And he came back and he wrote a book called They Thought They Were Free, which was out of print for a number of years. It's just very recently come back into print. And but it was published back in the 1950s. Milton Mayer is, I believe he's no longer with us. I may be wrong. And I just wanted to share with you a couple of paragraphs from the book. These are the comments of Germans in Germany after World War II, recalling what it was like as Germany was losing its freedom. Here's the first one, one of the people that he interviewed. This fellow said to Milton Mayer, he said, "What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure, or associated with true patriotic allegiance, or with real social purposes in some cases, and all the crises and reforms, and there were real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath, or the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. To live in this process," this fellow told him. This particular person he was interviewing was a college professor who lived through the time, who continued to teach college all through the years of Hitler. He says, "To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me. Unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, of acuity, than most of us ever had occasion to develop. Each step is so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must one day lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. And then one day, it's over his head." In this conversation, Milton Mayer's friend suggests that he wasn't making an excuse for not resisting the rise of the fascists, but simply pointing out an undisputable reality. He said, "This is how fascism will always take over a nation." Again, quoting this fellow that Mayer is talking to. "Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, and so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier, but still he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the school, the press, the Jews, and so on, and he was always a little uneasier, but still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but then it was too late." "Yes," I said, this is Mayer, and then back to, "You see, one doesn't exactly know where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even to talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. And it's not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor. And instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside in the streets, in the general community, everyone seems happy. No, one hears no protests, certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there are slogans against the government painted on the walls and fences. In Germany, outside of the great cities, perhaps there's not even this. in the university community, in my own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do, but what do they say? They say, hey, it's not so bad, or you're seeing things, or you're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You're saying that this must lead to that. But you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, they intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. And that one great shocking occasion, when tens or hundreds of thousands will join you, never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions would have been sufficiently shocked. If, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. So C is not so much worse than B. And if you did not make a stand at step B, then why should you at step C? And so on to step D. And then he talks about how the sudden realization comes over you that it has already gone beyond that point. It's already gone beyond the point of no return. And I'll share that with you. It's only two sentences. I'll share that with you after we come back from this break, because it is absolutely shocking. You get that the parallels between that time and today are so real. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I was riding the subway with 1,000 New Yorkers, headed downtown. An old woman shoved over, she made room for me to sit down. A young Hispanic couple cuddled in the corner, she hugged him, he gave her a kiss. The old woman smiled at them, she leaned over to me and whispered, this ain't love grand.
Ah, yes. And welcome back, my friends, from the sublime to the worrisome. Okay, I was sharing with you Martin Mayer's observations. He was talking with Germans who lived through and continue to work and do their jobs through the rise of Hitler, in this case a university professor, and he talks about how step C is not so much worse than step B, and if you didn't take a stand at step B, then how can you stand up for steps, you know, against step C and so on to step D? And then he says, and one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jew, swine, collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed. And completely changed under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, it's not the world you are in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, the spirit is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. Because when everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without even responsibility, even to God.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Yeah. And that is how, it, you know, to paraphrase E.E. Cummings, and this is how the world will end, and this is how democracy ends, not with a bang, but a whimper from O'Reilly, or Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. I encourage you to check out Friedman's column in the New York Times. So it's about a week old now. Fair, FAIR.org has a piece on their website. And you can drop a note to editor at nytimes.com and let them know what you think.
about the government creating blacklists of truth tellers, evildoers, collaborators, any kind of lists. This is just really and truly scary. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks for this being with us all week. Thanks to Louise for producing our program today and engineering it. We'll see you tomorrow, or see you on Monday. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.